Thank you for joining this afternoon's program of At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. It is the 23rd of March, almost a year to our anniversary here at Heritage Radio Network. And you're listening to At the Root of It, which broadcasts live at 4 p.m. every Tuesday. And to begin the show, I just want to do a thank you to Hearst Ranch, one of our grand sponsors here. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable, native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to www.hearstranch.com. We'll begin today with a brief recap of the week in wine. And in latest news that Stanislas Henriot, a previous guest on At the Root of It, has resigned as president of the family's champagne business after over a decade in charge, reports Decanter.com. The resignation has come to the surprise of many in Champagne and beyond, given that Henriot has overseen a big transformation of the business and the brand, which had once been relatively unknown outside of France. In explanation of his resignation, Henriot told a French newspaper, "The 40-year-old wants to go further. I did what I had to do, also creating our subsidiary in the USA. A family group such as ours needs to breathe. This is the case now. That is the only reason that I have decided to go. It is not yet known who will take over running the business, but it's unlikely that the other son will take over." And in other champagne news of the week, Dom Pérignon has launched its first Enotech Rosé. The 1999 vintage Enotech Rosé will be the first mature vintage rosé released by Dom Pérignon. The wine is a blend of 50% Pinot Noir and 50% Chardonnay grapes from Grand Cru sites and was disgorged in 2007. The DP Enotech Rosé is due to be released in the UK in April and expected to retail at £520 a bottle. I'm going to welcome my guest after this short break, who I met last week in San Francisco during the Cahors Malbec tour. Feels like I've been away from the studio quite a while, but it was good to be out in Napa and the surrounding region, meeting a whole new cast of characters. And Ken Payton writes for RainOfTerroir.com, a wine blog, and he will join us after this short break. You are listening to At the Root of It on the HeritageRadioNetwork.com. And I wanted to welcome my guest today, Ken Payton. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Very nice to hear from you, Aaron.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I was just saying before the break that you write the blog RainOfTerroir.com, and everyone in the studio here was getting quite a kick out of the name, so well done.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. It's no easy matter coming up with a new name. I was discussing various alternatives before coming up with a blog, and I'll tell you, a lot of the good ones have obviously been taken. There are so many.
Did you have to buy that domain from someone? I would imagine that actually would be
popular.
Yeah.
No, that shocked me. When I looked it up, no one had taken it for whatever reason. But then I began to discover perhaps why, because the blog was started maybe, 3 years ago, I guess, December of 2007. And among my first visitors via my stat counter was the federal government.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, wondering indeed what this new, I mean, in these difficult times, because terroir, of course, the name is very close to the pun.
Sure.
Reign of Terror from the French, from the era of the French Revolution. So there was some concern as to apparently as to what might be taking place on the blog pages, but they haven't been around for a very, very long time. So I think we've put
enough distance in there.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I was coming up with a name for my show before we launched, and one of the ones that Patrick Martins really liked was Purple Rain, and obviously spelled R-E-I-G-N as well. And I wasn't sure if it was going to be conflicting with the song Purple Rain or whatnot and what I'd have to deal with going forward. So.
Oh, best of luck with that. Oh, yes, as you probably know, Prince is extremely aggressive.
Yeah.
In all the copyright infringements. I mean, every so often you go onto YouTube, find one of his videos, it's up for a few hours, and then that's it. Extremely aggressive copyright protector.
That makes me feel better. I made the right move.
I'm confident you did.
So tell us a little bit about the reignofterroir.com and when you started writing for it.
Well, I've met some folks online. It was at Gary Vaynerchuk's winelibrary.com.
Uh-huh.
He has an extensive forum section. And I was a participant there for quite a while. And over the period of, a year or so, I began to notice certain patterns emerging amongst some of the contributors. And I had in the back of my mind for the longest time, starting a blog, it's very, very difficult, of course, because as Alice Fearing has so poignantly put it, if you want to start a blog about wine, make sure it's not just about what you like to drink.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a very high percentage of blogs that are currently out there. And there's nothing wrong with that, mind you. So lots of people make very handsome livings. Well, maybe not lots, but a few make very handsome livings off of doing precisely that, because consumers need to know. They need assistance, and oftentimes when you go into a store, of course, there's a very perplexing selection.
Sure.
I have no problems with that. But I wanted to write something a little bit different. I wanted to approach certain cultural and scientific matters that are frequently left off the blogosphere.
Mm-hmm.
For an assortment of reasons, availability of the proper data, being able to talk directly with scientists, and sometimes the wine history is very, very difficult to research because the online archives and databases have not included their, oftentimes their vast holdings. The Bancroft Library in Berkeley, for example, which has a huge amount of history on American winemaking traditions, is not searchable, and you can't use it as effectively as you might without
mm-hmm.
actually being present. And Wines and Vines, a magazine that's had steady publication in California for 100 years or so under various titles, they still have all of their historical database on microfiche. So they are in the process, it was rumored about a year and a half ago, of converting those microfiches to a digital searchable format.
But, okay. As via membership or something? Or?
Pardon me?
Via like a membership or something?
Well, perhaps. I think they'll just let it loose onto the world.
Mm-hmm,
they may put it on.
Mm-hmm.
They may put it on something portable, DVDs, Blu-ray, whatever, so that people can purchase it. But I think it's largely going to be an open source kind of searchable database. Because for one very simple reason, there aren't that many people out there. Some are writing on cultural matters, scientific, but even fewer are writing on historical matters. And so as a consequence, I'm not sure, apart from universities, how large the initial market would be if they attempt to monetize this particular information. So my suspicion is, like the National Geographic and New Yorker, that there may be, there will be a more user-friendly, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
more cost-effective ability. Because this information has to get out.
Yeah. Well, do you have a particular study that you've been able to position yourself to write about it? Have you studied? You're based in California, right?
Yeah, based in California. Well, I've since I'm in Santa Cruz, which is on the West Coast, of course,
mm-hmm.
about 70 miles south of San Francisco, we have our own little AVA. The Santa Cruz Mountains AVA was the first AVA to be based upon climatological and terrain matters.
The first one, okay.
We have a special claim to fame in that. We have a wide variety of microclimates. We have a west side and an east side, and we're just perpetually overshadowed by Napa and other other more well-endowed wine regions.
Yeah.
They can afford to pay a great deal more for publicity and advertisement. We have very, rather sleepy little promotional organizations here. So that certainly was one of the main areas. I love the wines here. We have cool climate, Pinot Noir, for example. And a lot of these wineries, roughly 80 in all, have very little presence in the U.S. market. People understand them. They don't understand them particularly well. I mean, Ridge's Montebello, for example, a name as high profile as that.
Right.
Nevertheless, and that's from Santa Cruz,
mm-hmm,
Mountains, AVA,
mm-hmm,
100%, from their vineyards up at Ridge itself. Most people, when you ask them, they'll say, oh, it must be Napa.
Right, or, right.
Same with Kathryn Kennedy, another very high profile
mm-hmm
producer. So there was a definite, apart from the high profile figures, there was also just the nuts and bolts producer, small producer. We have, since the mountains are so rugged and inhospitable, very hard to work, there's very little flat and even ground. So the total acreage, number of which escapes me at the moment, but the total acreage is rather small. So it's not uncommon to find producers who do just a few thousand bottles a year,
mm-hmm,
under 10,000 certainly.
So your particular bent then with the more scientific, you're going a little deeper into the historical roots, terroir, the makeup of the minerals and the elements in the soil and that and whatnot, which distinguishes your blog from others. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would think that's fair to say. But there's always, it distinguishes mine, but until another blog comes along, it's the division of labor within the wine world is rather narrow indeed, and there's ample room.
Yeah.
Despite what some pundits may say, there's ample room for additional blogs tackling these questions. Because it's astonishing to me that so many very important subjects go unchronicled. I mean, I have a backlog of material that's just absolutely mind-boggling to get to.
Right. It's a matter of getting up on the web, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot of work to post each day.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's almost, sometimes it's like an exercise in miniaturization, because the blog format itself, you have to catch readers, and only have a certain length of time. I mean, they're not going to, if they want to sit down for something really long, they'll read either an extensive magazine article or something out of a historical journal or cultural magazine, or they'll buy a book.
Mm-hmm.
So it presents unusual problems when you're writing a wine blog.
Let's talk about that a bit. I haven't really covered that. The general food or wine blogs, the social media, how that's changed the industry in some ways in terms of people reporting on views and scores and the credibility, given that print is in a challenging time right now. How have you seen it change? And in the wine industry in general, how do you think it's affected people?
Well, it's rather difficult to say. The obituaries for the wine blogging community are written by professionals daily. I mean, there obviously is, as with travel writers, professional travel writers, professional food writers, it must be happening, although official statistics are very hard to come by, of course. It must be happening that there is something that the revenue has fallen off for a lot of these official organizations. You add to that many of the professionals have been doing it for quite a few years and have been all over the world and are very skilled and have a great depth of understanding of particular regions that they covered. It's a work of passion. So simply by being a pro does not mean that your voice is somehow compromised. It just will often mean you spent a hell of a lot more time doing it until your expertise was recognized and you're hired by somebody to write it professionally.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this two-part answer, at least two parts.
Yeah.
One being the contrast, sometimes startling, between professional and amateur, which by and large is
mm-hmm
the blogosphere, but not exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, and the issue of eroding profit lines. So professionals tend to be a little on the nervous side. Some use blogs themselves. But if you flip that around from the perspective of wineries, they are very pleased because they have a more intimate way to communicate with their
consumers.
With their consumers.
Yeah.
And furthermore, it costs them zero engagement activity. So that's So it's not exclusively the bloggers who have eroded the bottom line. It's rather also the recognition on the part of various wineries, especially small ones who don't have large advertisement budgets, that they can embrace the blogosphere and get their message out to quite a few additional people, because it is a sort of immortal kind of medium. It will always be there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
5 years from now, you can look up, well, you are specifically engaged, your organization, Heritage,
right,
specifically engaged in the production of a archive database, historical database.
Yep.
So it will always, regrettably, perhaps, my voice will always somewhere be there.
Stop.
So
well,
that,
no,
and it, you
I
know,
mean,
costs us, but not, neither one of us, it doesn't cost either one of us a penny.
No, that's true.
I enjoy
it's
the conversation,
true.
and you constructively add to what will turn out to be in a very important database, I'm sure.
Well, thanks. I think it's on its way as well. But it is interesting, because I've spoken to a lot of freelance writers, and their budgets are, magazines, journals, papers have, obviously, their budgets have been cut. So mm-hmm. there aren't as many outlets for freelance writers to do work, essentially. So given this blogosphere and also dwindling revenues based on advertising there, it's just an interesting time to see which one kind of comes up and prevails in some way. I mean, hopefully they both do, but it's an interesting time to watch, because I think credibility wise, people still look to print mm-hmm. for that kind of final answer, or documented, whether it's a scoring, whether it's a review or a feature. It seems that once it's in print, it has this kind of finality, which is like the final word, as opposed to people being able to necessarily comment on it in a forum-like way, which a lot of the writings that are
right.
done after tastings or something like that are documented on the web. So,
which is precisely why I decided in the very beginning, from the very founding of the blog, Rain of Terroir, not to engage in that kind of transitory. That kind of transitory writing for which the magazines are so adept.
Yeah, yours is more of a continuous exploration of different subjects.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when the difference in mine, I don't know if it's when UC Davis reads your piece, or San Luis Obispo or Cornell, there's an extraordinary amount of personal satisfaction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And also when you talk to many of these behind the scenes, nameless scientists, whose words are important for shaping debates, global warming, for example, or any number of other issues, it's always satisfying to be able to talk to them directly. They're sort of like the scientific community is sort of like the missing element
yeah.
in a lot of this discussion, because they have opinions, they have approaches, they have certain scientific protocols, they have influence,
mm-hmm.
they have responsibilities, and it's often surprising to me that more of them are not interviewed.
Yeah.
So that's certainly what I try to do. And on my blog right now, for example, is an interview with Gregory V. Jones, who's America's foremost climatologist with respect to viticultural matters. And he's written some very, very important papers, and they're often cited, but nowhere could I find, apart from print, strangely, nowhere could I find, and I couldn't access it because it was subscription-only
yeah.
database, could I find an actual live interview with the
yeah.
guy. So it's those kinds of things. It adds the very important, my blog, I hope, in a small way, adds very important voices in the scientific community to an ongoing debate about wine acceptors. So it's not always about what you think of California Chardonnay and the Oak Regimen. I mean, for crying out loud, I've asked those questions so many times, I simply refuse to ask them ever again.
Well, I'd love for you to share, you stay on the line and talk a bit about endangered terroirs and the documentary that you've done. And for our listeners, in the meantime, you can look at Reign of Terroir, R-E-I-G-N of Terroir, terroir.com, to reference the articles that Ken is speaking of. A thank you once again to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, and to our engineer and producer, Jack Inslee, today on At the Root of It. And my guest today is Ken Payton from reignofterroir.com. And we just wrapped up the previous segment speaking a bit about blogging in the social media sphere with respect to wine blogs. And Ken, I know you've had a bunch of different experiences, and I'd love to just zone in on one in the second half of the show because it is very in line with the Heritage mission as well. Endangered terroirs. This was a topic you and I had touched upon via email. And what are some that you've come across that, you know, maybe a lot of people don't know about?
Well, I'm currently working on a documentary. It's not hasn't been finished yet. We've shot all the promo, all the promotional footage. And it's a documentary we plan to shoot in Portugal around the harvest time in late August, early September, and forward. It essentially concerns itself with Portuguese historical wines and with certain wine regions that are under threat through development or through pressure from what you might call contentiously the globalization of taste, the internationalizing of wine styles. Portugal, as you may know, has dozens and dozens of indigenous native varietals, being some of the strangest, most interesting, unusual wines that you will ever enjoy. And many of these, if you take, for example, Ramisco, which is grown, they're ungrafted Ramisco vines, pre-phylloxera Ramisco vines, still being grown in Coladish, which is just outside of Lisbon, have been grown on bare sand. Because they're grown in sand, they were able to successfully withstand the phylloxera that devastated most of Europe's vineyards last century. So they are under tremendous pressure from developmental interests, for example, real estate interests. There are many second homes and tourist homes, shall we say, world traveler homes, that have been built on old vineyards that used to be quite prevalent along that area. And the Ramisco grape, as a result, these pre-phylloxera vines are under considerable threat. Mm. The area has been considered, the Sintra area, as a national park, but still does not have, owing to the vagaries of legal enforcement within Portugal itself, does not enjoy all of the legal protections. So when I was out there most recently, here I am talking to a wine grower named Gonzalo, and he's about 70 years old. He has nobody to take up his work after he's gone. He's very fit, very trim, maybe 75, can't remember. In any event, he has this plot of vines that are growing directly on the surface of the sand itself. It's the only way near the Atlantic is you can grow grapes in this particular region. And when they flower and when the fruit sets, he'll then raise them off of the ground, keep them off of the heat from the day with special little spikes designed to support them. And there are dozens of small producers, just like this gentleman, who sell all their grapes to the collective and all share in the whatever funds are generated. And there are two small wineries that take the collected wine and do and provide their own vinification barreling technique.
How much production are we talking about here, or do you know?
The Adega itself, the winery itself, cellar, which is the word Adega means, we're probably looking at, I can't remember the exact figure, somewhere around 20,000 bottles top.
Okay.
So that figure, I have to hold off on that figure, but somewhere in that neighborhood.
Okay.
So, and they usually sell out often to the tourist industry, to wine shops in Lisbon, etc. But there's really, at present, there's no mechanism to prevent the sale of a vineyard to a real estate concern. That's one. And then there, up in the north, in the Mino area, in the Vino Verde, there's a type of viticulture with vines 4 meters tall that produce a bracing Vino Verde, very, very different in style from what one finds in the States.
Uh-huh.
And they have extremely little representation. And what is mostly understood as Vino Verde is, by the West, is the result of a few savvy exporters who figured out what the American palate might want. And in the Tao, you have a similar, some similar issues as well. Trigonational is somewhat under threat, although it's it would be too much to say that it is endangered. They are under threat to remove their indigenous varietals and to replant them with internationally recognized varietals. Marketing being what it is, no one knows what Trigonational is on the label.
Right.
No one knows what Romishko is on the label. So people want to see reassuring and comforting things, at least according to the marketing geniuses.
What are they looking to plant there? Like
It was suggested to them by certain people here out of the United States that they plant Cabernet.
Okay.
Cabernet Sauvignon. So to grub up historical vines, to eliminate, to take out of circulation all of these glorious expressions.
Now, did they do research to determine whether or not Cabernet would indeed grow there well? I mean, it's pretty far north.
Well, you know, here's part of the problem. With the endangered terroirs, one of the reasons they're also endangered is that they often rely upon traditional winemaking techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Portugal being the poorest country in old Europe, many of the winemakers simply don't have the resources to invest in brand spanking new technology.
Yeah.
So as a result, they don't, you know, they concentrate on older oak barrels. Some of them are over 100 years old. I've seen some clay jars from the clay jar wine area, for example, that are from the 17th century. So
There,
as a matter of fact, that particular technology of fabricating clay jars has actually been lost. And one of the subsets of questions we're looking at is how to perhaps reintroduce that clay jar technology back into common practice.
So that will be part of in your documentary as well?
That'll be part of the documentary,
yeah.
Yes. So it's clay jar wines in the around Via Frades area. They're in the Alentejo. There are some additional vineyards and grape varieties. The question is also complicated by EU restrictions. One of the ways to maintain stable prices for everyone, for all growers, is to remove those unprofitable plots out of circulation.
Right.
No matter what is on them. So if, for example, EU says, well, you know, nobody is interested in Bobal too terribly much, or no one is interested in some other fairly obscure varietal, then the call goes out, well, perhaps we should just take those vines completely out of circulation, plant them with something that will guarantee a higher return.
Mm-hmm.
So the multiple pressures, and additionally with the Azores, that's another area we're visiting, the islands off the coast of Portugal. They, too, have absolutely astonishing and amazing wines and have virtually zero representation.
Wow. So your documentary is really going to then hone in on Portugal. Is it on Portugal itself?
It's specifically on the historical
wines,
endangered wines of Portugal, yes.
Interesting. Great.
Mm-hmm. And then we plan another one further down the line.
Yeah.
On the Canary Islands and some other select targets.
And then maybe there'll be a whole series, a whole volumes of these videos which really unleash what's going on in these regions.
Yeah, and of course it presents unusual challenges because you're talking about things that are not, not happy, playful topics.
No, yeah.
So the idea is to make it quite entertaining, as many of these winemakers certainly are, and to make it an encouraging and a hopeful kind of documentary.
Give them reason to continue to do what they're doing and stay true to the wines that are best representative of their place.
Indeed, of the jar wines, for example, I was astonished to read when my link to one of my stories was picked up and put in some other forum that everyone who commented said I'd never even heard that such a thing even existed, and I would love to lay my hands on them. So, in addition to the preservation thrust of the documentary, there's also a hope that commercial interest can be awakened.
Yeah, absolutely.
The last thing the world needs is another Cabernet.
Right.
And if you have dozens and dozens of varietals no one has ever tasted, then all of a sudden Portugal can easily be seen, in my opinion, as the world's last great reservoir of unknown wines and unknown terroirs.
Interesting. Well, that's
great. So that's my principal principal targets.
Well, kudos to you for championing that and sharing it with us.
Yes, well, it's in the air. There are a lot of people who have been discussing these matters, but usually from a marketing perspective, and usually by telling everyone what extraordinary bargains they are, you know, which is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, yes, they're bargains. On the other hand, the idea is to get a fair price.
Yeah.
For the extraordinary stuff, extraordinary juice that these people actually produce, and it's that fair price that will be also one of the focuses. Because who cares if it's cheap? If essentially you're putting, you're maintaining hardly subsistence farming on the part of those who produce that wine. So to awaken the market, awaken consumers to the importance of these historical terroirs, very much in keeping with your approach.
Absolutely. Heritage. Yeah, I think that there are a few people in the States that I've spoken to, namely one being John Priest from Etude, who was doing a Charbonneau heritage project in just a very small couple lines of vines in the vineyard, but saving them because they were original to the property. And sounds like the Portuguese could certainly continue to do that if they can afford to do that. And getting the word out that they're trying to will certainly help their cause. So that's great. We'll look forward to it. Does it have a name yet that we can look out for?
Or? We don't have an operational title yet.
Okay.
It would have been smart of me to come up with one. But something along
names are tough, as we just began the show talking about. So,
yeah, the idea is once again is to try to combine a more playful tone, and so the title becomes a work of poetry as much as
sure.
You know, as much as a work
not
product.
So grave, if you will, right?
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we have to wrap up because we have another show coming on this afternoon on the network, but. We only scratch the surface with what I know you have going on and can share. So hopefully we can have another conversation in the future.
I would love to. That would be absolutely delightful.
Great. Well, thanks again. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we sign off?
No, just congratulations on the Heritage's upcoming anniversary.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's exciting. We'll do a big blast. If you're in New York, you have to come through.
How delightful. And what extraordinary wines I had the other day at the San Francisco Cahors tasting. Just brilliant.
Good. Well,
brilliant Malbecs.
So glad you enjoyed those. Yeah. Kind of goes in line with what you're saying about reawakening the public, the consumers to...
That's exactly right. Right in my alley.
Yeah, exactly.
Right in my alley.
Well, cheers, Ken. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
you take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
And thanks to our listeners for joining this afternoon and to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, and Jack Inslee. See you next week. We have Michael, the chef from Le Caprice, coming on the network. Cheers.